Welcome to the Lost Debate, a show for political eclectics. I'm Ravi Gupta, and it is an amazing time to be a resident of the great city of New York. First of all, in more trivial matters, last night the Knicks were trailing 101-96 with 47 seconds to go. And I know this is not a sports podcast, but what a moment in New York. 101-96, 47 seconds left, and then they wind up winning 104-101 in just an absolutely bizarre, crazy finish. And I talk about this because I've said this in other contexts, but the Knicks are the only team in New York that has like 100% approval from real New Yorkers, right? I live right next to Barclays where the Brooklyn Nets play. I lovingly call them the Montauk Nets. They are just not, it's where, you know, people who are not really real New Yorkers go to watch basketball. And I go there to root against the Nets, which we could talk about. It's just a fraudulent franchise and no real New Yorker supports them. The Knicks, on the other hand, are a true marker of a real New Yorker, whether you're born and raised here, which almost 100% of us are Knicks fans. I was born in Brooklyn, still a Knicks fan. I live next door to the Nets facility, still a Knicks fan. We've watched James Dolan destroy the franchise, still a Knicks fan. This is a fun season for us because there were no expectations coming in. And so going up 2-0 against Philly is great. It's a true New York moment, whether you love sports or not. Basketball has such a unique place in the hearts of New Yorkers. And there's a wonderful documentary by one of my best friends. It's called Point Gods. It's on Showtime by a guy named Sam Snead. Sam Elliott, he also goes by. It's all about the history of the point guard position and how New York revolutionized it. So wonderful, wonderful time to be in New York right now as it relates to basketball. Now, in less fun news, New York is in the middle of all of it right now. In Lower Manhattan, we've got this Trump trial going on, which is a true circus. So you go across the bridge and you've got just incredible Secret Service presence. You've got the most important trial, probably since OJ, maybe more important, going on in Lower Manhattan. And then all the way uptown, you've got the site of this encampment of Columbia students who are protesting, and where Columbia has actually ceased classes right now. They're not actually holding classes because of this protest that's going on. And the president of Columbia has called in the police to arrest their own students, which is obviously a controversial move that's prompted a huge debate up there. I plan on going up there at some point in the next couple of days if this continues. So I'll report from there. Later this week, we're going to have a fun episode where we talk about both the Trump trial with some experts there and potentially, and I won't say exactly who yet because we just got to make sure it comes through, but an author I have wanted to interview for a long, long time about some issues that we talk about a lot on this podcast. But this sort of surge of protests that's happening around the country is something I will be commenting on more in the future. I'm trying to be careful not to just jump to any anecdotes. Right now, there's like a trading of anecdotes in the media. I want to have like a pretty thorough sense of what's happening out there before I comment on it. But what I will say is the timing of this is interesting because this morning we found out that we won that Webby Award that I asked you guys to vote on. And we didn't win the People's Choice Award. We actually won the full-on award. There's like a award that's voted on by the judges. And we won that in recognition of our coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, particularly the series that we did, the Unbiased History Parts 1 and 2, and then the Hamas Explainer that we did. And I know so many of you as an audience came here because of those episodes, because those are the most listened to episodes we've ever had. So I want to thank you as an audience for supporting us. Those awards mean a lot to us because it's, you know, recognition of work that we've done. And I did not think we were going to win because there's so many conflicting feelings about that conflict that even trying to do an unbiased history could piss off people. And I just didn't expect us to emerge victorious. That is just wonderful news at a time when the debate around the conflict is so depressing and divided. So thank you as an audience. I also want to plug a new show that we have. And this is from the folks over at the National Parents Union. And it's launching tomorrow, which is 4/24. It's called the National Parents Union Podcast. It's a collaboration between us and the National Parents Union, which is a group of parents who basically take it upon themselves to advocate for better schools. They have more than 1,000 affiliated parent organizations in all 50 states, and they are an advocate for families. And the mission statement of the podcast is that they are going to put kids back at the center of policy and politics. and are going to be a rallying cry and a voice to mobilize and break down systemic barriers and enact real change. So you could listen to that every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts. You could search for the National Parents Union podcast or click on it in our link. And with that, we have a great guest today. We're going to talk about all things healthcare with a reporter that I really respect, who's on the cutting edge, both of technology in healthcare, but also public policy in healthcare. And also her work bleeds over to drug issues and decriminalization and criminal justice policy. So with that, let's jump in. Well, I'm excited to welcome on Carmen Pond, who is the global health reporter for Politico. She previously spent 5 years covering health policy at Politico in Brussels, where she wrote about access to pricey therapies for children with rare diseases, growing old with HIV, Eastern Europe's healthcare systems. And she's really been on the beat for a while. And a story she wrote about Oregon's drug decriminalization really caught our attention because we've been doing a few segments on this over the past few years. And so we figured we'd welcome Carmen on to update us on all things that are happening there, as well as a whole bunch of other healthcare stories. Carmen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
So I was reading this in your bio. It says you speak Romanian, French, Italian, and Spanish, obviously in addition to English.
Yes.
It's pretty amazing. How do you find time to learn all those different languages?
I started early. I started as a kid. So I'm originally Romanian.
I was going to say, that was going to be my guess, because that's the rarer of those languages.
I think there are very few people who learn Romanian as a foreign language. But yeah, so Italian came very easy. It's very close to Romanian. Many Romanians would understand it almost without taking lessons. French and English, I learned it early in school. And then Spanish, I actually, funny enough, people always laugh when I tell them this, but when I was a teenager, I loved the Latin American soap operas, the telenovelas. So I used to watch it. And because I already had the background in French and in Italian, it sort of like came easy to understand it. It's actually my favorite language. People many times, because of my name, Carmen, think that I am from Latin America, which I don't mind. You know, I could speak Spanish with a very weird accent. So then they're like, where are you actually from?
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. Super impressive. The reason why we had you on today is because you wrote this article about Oregon. We'll link in our show notes to some earlier coverage we did on this, but let's take it from the beginning. Oregon had, I guess, a unique law as it relates to the enforcement of their drug policies. Tell us a little bit about what that law said.
So in 2020, there was a ballot measure in Oregon to decriminalize possession of small quantities of drugs for personal use. And the purpose was to treat this as purely a health issue, not a criminal issue. So if someone was caught on the streets of Portland, for example, with a small amount of drugs, that most likely was for their own personal consumption and not for selling, they wouldn't be arrested, you know, they wouldn't be prosecuted, but they would be directed to treatment. So there was a ballot measure in 2020 that passed. And in 2021, the law was implemented to decriminalize possession of hard drugs for personal use. And at the time, and, you know, since, Oregon was the only state in the United States that had that law. And just a few weeks ago, the governor of Oregon, Tina Kotek, actually signed a law rolling back that decriminalization. So as of September, again, possessing hard drugs becomes a crime. It's not a sort of like high-level crime, if I can call it that way. So you won't automatically be sent to jail, but you could be arrested for it in some parts of Oregon, depending on how the different counties will end up applying this new law.
Tell us a little bit about why such a quick rollback of this policy. What was happening on the ground, both anecdotally, but also what can we tell from the data about the effect this law had on the population?
The drug overdose deaths in Oregon skyrocketed over the past few years, and there are people who blame decriminalization for it. They're saying, obviously, if people think, okay, it's not a crime to use drugs anymore, I will use it. Maybe more people would do it. Advocates argue that this was already happening, and this really tracks with what happened in the rest of the country when fentanyl, which is this synthetic opioid, came onto the scene and people started using it, and it's lethal in very small amounts. So, you know, even if you use it for the first time, you could die from a very small amount of fentanyl. And then obviously public drug use became rampant in Portland specifically. There were a lot of people using drugs on the street. People in the area felt unsafe, felt their community was sort of like out of control, and they wanted policymakers to do something about it. Again, there's a dispute between what really caused it. There have been some studies showing that, you know, homelessness was already a big issue in Portland before decriminalization happened. Then we had the pandemic. Just recently, about a year or so ago, many of the safety measures around housing put in place during the pandemic were taken away. So more people potentially ended up living on the street and using drugs on the street. So it made the issue very public, very sort of like in your face. While as obviously if people would have housing and they would be using drugs in their homes, it wouldn't be such an obvious problem as it was. So many people are demanding change. There was already a movement towards a new ballot to actually roll back decriminalization. This would have happened this November. But the Oregon legislature decided that they needed to do something about it themselves. And they passed a new law that they debated a long time, basically saying this is a crime again. Possessing hard drugs for personal use is a crime again. But in this new law, they have sort of like different off-ramps, if we can call it that, where, you know, if you are caught with drugs, you don't necessarily get put in jail and left there, but you have options to pursue treatment that would then, you know, allow you to avoid going to jail and being prosecuted. There are about three or four different stages that you can sort of like seek treatment, seek support if you have a substance use disorder, so you don't end up in jail.
To sort of put a fine point on it, you know, you talk about the arguments for the sort of supporters of the original law. One was they say that if overdose deaths are the main concern, they point to, you talked about the national statistics of overdose deaths, but even neighboring Washington State, which you point out in your article, had a higher rate of overdose deaths than Oregon did, even though Washington had the more restrictive law. That's one part of it. The other part that sort of supporters of the original law say is that there wasn't an investment, part of this, an initial investment in treatment to the extent that, or a requisite investment, and that the promise of this policy was that they would shift resources and have a robust approach to treatment. Is there any truth to that? Like there was at least either a lag in investment or an underinvestment in treatment?
Absolutely. So to start with the baseline, when decriminalization was implemented in Oregon, the state ranked the last in the nation in its capacity to provide treatment to people with substance use disorders. And one of the aim of the decriminalization law was to improve that. So there was about $150 million a year that would be used to expand capacity for treatment. This was money coming from the cannabis tax. But that money rolled out really late. It rolled out about a year and a half after decriminalization happened. So what you had in that first year and a half was decriminalization was a fact. You wouldn't be criminally punished for being found with drugs. But even if you tried to seek treatment, there wasn't enough capacity to respond to that. The other thing was that there was a hotline that people could call. So basically, instead of being arrested, if they were confronted by the police, they would get a ticket with a number to call to sort of like get screened and potentially get treatment. And research shows that very few people actually called that number. And there's also a debate about whether that was the right way to send people to treatment, and that maybe it, you know, you had to have more people on the ground, social workers actually talking to people and trying to convince them in many cases that they need help, because that's also a problem. Many times people, you know, are afraid of withdrawal symptoms, or they don't necessarily want to recognize they have a problem. They don't want to see themselves as sick, and then they refuse treatment. So there is, you know, there was still a lot of work to do, and the money rolled out pretty late, and that definitely impacted how the law impacted things on the ground.
And people, and you do go through this in your article, the sort of comparison point is Portugal. What did Portugal do? And what were the results of Portugal? Because it's often heralded as like the example of this kind of policy working.
Indeed. And, you know, that was also why we wanted to understand why this worked in Portugal and why it didn't work in Oregon. So Portugal decriminalized drugs in 2001. One important difference is that they didn't have to deal with fentanyl at the time. They were dealing with heroin. And in many parts of Europe, fentanyl is not really a problem. It hasn't become a problem. And obviously they hope it's not going to become a problem. So the sort of like the nature of the drug was different. And many argued that, you know, it was a lot easier to fight heroin than to fight fentanyl, which is so deadly now. So again, they decriminalized possession of small amounts of drugs. And they basically, like, if the police would find you on the street with drugs, you would be sent in front of this commission that would basically assess, you know, do you have severe substance use disorder? What kind of help you need? And then you would go into treatment. You would sort of like be really pushed into that treatment. But at no point in Portugal's decriminalization movement, you would have the threat of jail or being arrested or having criminal charges. It would always be, you have to go to this sort of like administrative, like there would be fines. The police would, in some cases, if they find you many times on the street with drugs, they would maybe take you themselves and take you in front of this commission. But the idea was to sort of like have all the doors open for people to seek treatment without threatening them with jail if they don't do it.
You know, part of me thinks like when people, when I was talking to people, and we have a lot of audience members in Oregon and Portland, when I talked to people about what they didn't like about that law, it wasn't just the overdoses. It was almost like the vibes. Like you're walking around the streets, people are doing drugs in front of you. And that's what I find interesting about this debate is it's being argued on the public health spectrum, right? Like, is it good for the drug users and all that? But I don't get the sense that that's the main thrust of what's going on here. Like, yes, I believe that like the Oregon residents are, you know, they care about their fellow people, et cetera. But I think this sort of, at a primal level, people don't like whatever's happening on the streets of Portland. They don't like the way it looks. They don't like walking down the street with their kids and just having their kids see people using drugs in plain sight. They don't like to take over the streets. Am I wrong about that? Like, that's just my theory.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it's uncomfortable. I think any one of us would be uncomfortable witnessing people doing drugs. You know, I told you about my origins. I'm from Romania. I remember we had, when I was growing up in my neighborhood, we had a really bad phase where all of a sudden there were a lot of drugs and there were people doing drugs. And I remember one morning going down the stairs to go to school in my apartment building and someone was injecting drugs on the stairs. And I was really scared because I didn't know, you know, is this person gonna like, you know, try to attack me in some ways? What sort of like mental state are they in? I remember that feeling. And I totally understand witnessing that on the streets of a city like Portland or anywhere. It's uncomfortable. You know, if you're with your kids, obviously you don't want to see that. Based on my reporting, it looked like that was one of the main triggers of rolling back decriminalization because it just gave people the feeling of lawlessness. It gave people the feeling, you know, feeling unsafe walking on the streets in downtown Portland. And some of the people that argue against decriminalization or argue for rolling back the law actually said that, you know, if you do this, you have to do it in a way where drug use doesn't become rampant on the street. You have to do it in a place where you have enough capacity to treat people, where maybe you don't have so many people that don't have housing or that you have found a solution to try to get more people in housing so they don't end up using on the street. So that's totally one of the reasons why, you know, lawmakers that I talked to felt like they had to really roll this back because they said like, you know, this was getting out of control. We had to do something about it.
It's important to note that the law that currently exists on the books, the new law, is still pretty permissive compared to a lot of other places in the country. Like, yes, there's the option to send people to jail, but people do, there's so many different ways that you could redirect people into treatment. And my hope from seeing this is that the sort of capacity to treat catches up with the demand, no matter what the sort of law says about whether this is a criminal act or not, or what kind of flexibility gives people. It seems like one thing that most people can agree on is that more treatment is helpful. Even the Republicans, who seem to be some of the most vocal supporters of the rollback, acknowledge that like they're sort of, I forget the guy's name who you quote in your article, sort of, I think the minority leader in the legislature says, look, he's like, it's about law enforcement and it's about treatment. And so I think like boosting the treatment side is really helpful. And that makes me think of some recent reporting you did outside of Oregon, which is about here in New York City. Because the big question is, what do you do with people who are addicted to drugs, right? You can't ignore it because that's not going to solve the problem. and you want to treat it like a public health issue, and depending on your theory, maybe as a public safety issue as well. You did some reporting on safe injection sites and other types of mechanisms in places like New York, where people are able to do drugs. So, you know, in the first part of this conversation, we're talking about people doing drugs in plain sight. An alternative is to have people do drugs in a safer way, kind of away from the public eye. What's going on in New York?
So in New York, there are two safe injection sites or overdose prevention centers where people with substance use disorder can actually go and do drugs, use illicit substances under supervision. And the main point of that is making sure that if someone overdoses, there's someone there that knows what to do to save that person's life. The basic assumption of safe injection sites is that, you know, there will always be some number of people, you know, you always hope there are fewer and fewer, but there will always be some number of people doing drugs. And if you want to make sure that their lives are safe, that they don't do it on their own and there's no one there to call 911 if they're having an overdose or, you know, to use Narcan if they used an opioid. If you want to save their life, then they could go to one of these sites and use their drugs there. These two centers in New York City are sort of like pilots. They are part of the activities that they support, which is, you know, trying to funnel people to treatment, in many cases trying to help them with housing, because many of the people that use this site since they opened in 2021 were people who didn't have housing or they had unstable housing. So part of it is funded by the city of New York, but just the sort of like main activity or the core of it, actually someone supervising someone doing drugs, is not, because it still involves an illicit activity. And that's the thing with safe prevention, safe injection sites, is that they are controversial in themselves. Some people feel that you actually encourage people to do drugs, that you don't try to tell them not to do it, help them kick that addiction. Obviously, no community wants to have such a site in their area because they feel that it would attract many people using illicit substances, that, you know, there might be disturbances. Many politicians, you know, again, like, because it's controversial, they are concerned about endorsing it, about obviously giving it public funding because they could be encouraging an illicit activity. So, you know, the data that we have from these two sites in New York since 2021, actually we have the data for the first year, shows that they work at saving lives, that most of the people using it were actually people who would have ended up using it on the street because they don't have housing or have pretty unstable housing. But, you know, they do say it's a gray legal zone. Funding is a problem because you cannot get public money for supervising someone doing drugs. So it's sort of like a hard balance to strike right now in terms of perception, public policies, and really saving lives and keeping people off the street doing drugs, which is, as we were saying, what triggered a change in Oregon.
And so the data you provide here says that in the 2 years after the sites opened, more than 2,800 people have used their services almost 50,000 times, and that staff had to intervene to reverse an overdose during about 1% of those visits. So that's 636 potential life-saving events. And nobody has died, at least according to your reporting, in these facilities. It seems like a win. Now, do people procure their own drugs on the street and then they bring them in? Is that right?
Yes, exactly. Yes. No one provides drugs in those sites. So people consume what they have.
Got it. So that could include fentanyl and all this kind of stuff. And
indeed.
That's so fascinating. And what happens now? Is there talk of scaling these up and also bringing them to other cities?
So many cities have looked into it. It's not yet being scaled up. As far as I understand, the federal government itself is funding a study on the centers over the next 3 years. They really want to sort of like compare potentially with areas that don't have the sites to see the difference that the sites make. The hopes for people in the harm reduction space, people who want to keep people alive, is that this will be scaled up, that these two sites in New York City will show that this works, that, you know, people who have sort of like reluctance, ethical, moral reluctance to this should leave it aside because these are really life-saving interventions. But whether this will be scaled up, whether it will get sort of like the political backing it needs, whether laws will be changed so it's not illegal to supervise someone, you know, doing drugs, I think that remains to be seen.
Well, okay, let me shift gears and ask you about one other topic. You've been doing pretty consistent reporting along with another, members of your team on Politico about AI in healthcare. And you kind of cover like each advance on its own. So you recently talked about heart imaging technology that allows AI basically to diagnose common cardiac conditions. And there was an article published in JAMA's Cardiology that argued that AI could be used for predicting aortic stenosis, which is the narrowing the valve that connects the heart to the body's main artery, something that afflicts like a million Americans. And there had tremendous results, it seems like, from that. There was another article you wrote about sepsis and an algorithm that can predict sepsis. And then you recently wrote about how some prominent members of the medical community are calling on Congress to regulate some of these AI technologies. Where do you stand now? Like, I think, and maybe to use a dramatic claim, what do you make of the claim that AI could replace doctors and medical professionals in the near-term future, like in the next couple decades?
So far, what everything points toward is that that's not going to happen. I think everyone is concerned that AI is going to go after their jobs. You know, I, as a journalist, for sure, I'm concerned about that. Many other people are. What we're trying to do with our newsletter, Future Pulse, that does cover, as you said, many AI developments in healthcare, is to sort of like cut through the hype, because at times it feels like AI can do everything and nothing. So definitely, it doesn't look like AI will be the one taking a decision on your diagnostic. It could help, especially, you know, I cover global health. And in areas, for example, that don't have radiologists, and you go for a scan of your lungs to see if you have tuberculosis, but there's no radiologist to read it and say, oh yeah, you might have it, or, you know, refer you to further screening or to a doctor, AI could actually help sort of like read that and play that role of a radiologist. But it doesn't mean that, doctors will be replaced by AIs and there will be machines taking care of us, at least not in the near future, because AI is still, even though it's developing so fast, it still looks like it's in the early stages. There's always the question about what data it uses to sort of like come up with what is called decision, but it's basically, you know, it makes like statistical predictions, right, based on the data it has. So the more data you feed for it to be able to identify, you know, if someone has tuberculosis on a scan or some other type of disease, you know, the more accurate it could be. But it doesn't mean that AI, you know, this machine basically that is based on statistics will have, at least for now, sort of like the final say over someone's healthcare.
And what's, like, of all the technologies in medicine that you've been covering related to AI, what is the one that you think is the most exciting and most promising? Is it the sort of radiology focused technologies?
It's hard to say. There's so many different ones. I think definitely because I cover global health and there are many places where there are not many healthcare workers to take care of people and to, you know, to screen them. I think if AI could, you know, I don't think it could replace fully a healthcare professional, but if it could help with that, you know, because it's so hard to train a medical professional and to have it in a certain place. I think that's very exciting. If we see that leap from, you know, having no healthcare professionals in a wide area to at least having some sort of way for people that are not necessarily so highly trained to screen someone and potentially refer them if they think based on sort of like AI screening that they need further diagnosis. The other area that I think it's exciting, although also in the very early stages, is drug discovery. Just feeding a lot of data into the AI and see what potential compound could respond to a potential condition. That's also in the early stages. One of the big problem of that is that unlike AI applications like ChatGPT that uses language, that uses stuff that is like freely available on the internet, the data for drug discovery is mostly owned by pharmaceutical companies, is proprietary. So, you know, you don't have, if you're one company, you don't have all the data that you would need for the AI to make a certain prediction. So one of the things that we will need to sort of like figure out in the next few years is how companies could potentially pull that data. So, you know, AI models could actually say, hey, you know, I found 300 potential compounds that could be useful in, you know, treating or ideally curing this type of cancer, for example. So I think that's very exciting. We're still not there yet, but it's probably going to get there, hopefully in the near future.
Well, that's a promising note to end on. Carmen, thank you for joining us. Where should people go to find your work, like plug your newsletter, your column, everything else you got going on?
Thank you. So they can find me on X at Carmen Pond. I write for Future Pulse, which is a daily newsletter that publishes every day at 2 p.m. Eastern. People can sign up to get it in their inbox, and they can also find it on Politico's website. And that's where we do most of the coverage on AI and healthcare, and that's freely available for everyone.
Well, thank you so much, Carmen.
This has been great. Thank you so much for having me. It's great talking to you.
Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Remember to rate, review, and subscribe. Our voicemail is 321-200-0570. That's 321-200-0570. We will be back Thursday with a really exciting episode.